Good morning. My name is Keith Lewis, and I'm an alcoholic. I'm a member of the Living Sober Group in Ocala, Florida. Julie and I are new Floridians. I was born in Martins Ferry, Ohio, a small town on the Ohio River just south of Pittsburgh. And, Alcoholics Anonymous started in Ohio. I know you know that, but I say that in case there's anybody here from California. You know, I was a second child, the eldest son in a family of 10 children. And my parents were absolutely magnificent. We were, they both had alcoholic parents. And we were materially very poor, but the house I lived in was spiritually very, very wealthy. My mother had never completed high school. And because she had an alcoholic mother and a father she never met. And she was an illegitimate child. And she never completed high school till the 10th child completed high school. Then she went to high school. And she took her SATs and she outscored all of us. And I said, "Mom, that's magnificent." She said, "It's nothing, son. I've been through high school 11 times. She's absolutely a brilliant woman. And she read us poetry every night. And every night after we said grace before the dinner meal, she would make us repeat a grammatical rule. Or we had to learn a word a week. We had to learn a definition. We had to use it three times. And she also, I used to string an antenna around, and we would pick up the opera every Saturday night from Pittsburgh. And prior to the opera, I'd have to go to the library and study it. And she was just unbelievable. She really was. And my father was the most humble man I ever knew in my life. He's just absolutely incredible man. And they were both just phenomenal love machines. You know, I was born a terrified little kid. And, there was something that lived under my bed. And I knew what it was there for. It was waiting for me to dangle my little legs over the side of the bed and I'd be history. And, my fear drove me as a little kid, and it drove me as an alcoholic. And, you know, it's amazing to me. Early on, when I got into Alcoholics Anonymous in 1973, an old-timer told me, his name was Jack. He's a good friend of Buck D. And he told me, he said, "You need to look back in your life." He said, "A big part of the 11th step is looking back in your life and seeing how God had his hand on you the whole time." And that's absolutely true. And, I was such a fear-driven, defiant little jerk. And, when I was a little kid, I had a horrible speech impediment. Nobody could understand anything I said. And so when I was in the first grade, the nun took me over to the library. And some of you older folks will remember this. They used to have these big red records. And she said, "We want somebody who speaks pretty good English." So they gave me a record of Winston Churchill's war talks. And so the nun told me, she said, "Play a sentence, then repeat it." And so I tried to do that. And I was the only kid in the Ohio Valley with a British accent. And a great miracle took place as far as my speaking. When I was 11 years old, I had my appendix out, and my grandmother, who was also a periodic alcoholic, but was sober a fairly long time before she died, and she was a great lover of St. Jude, and she came to the hospital before my surgery, and she knelt down next to my bed and prayed for me. And then she slipped a medal of St. Jude on my nightgown, and I went up to have my appendix taken out. And the doctors back then, they would admit mistakes. And and he told my parents, "I improperly clamped that little boy's tongue and it split." And they sewed my tongue up, and when the swelling went down, I could talk. an absolute miracle. God had his hand on me the whole time. So I go off to high school, and again, I was in a lot of trouble. You know, if we'd had any money, I think I'd have been diagnosed as an acting out adolescent. We were poor, so I was just a punk. And when I served detention with Sister Victoria in the library, she'd put me behind a magazine rack, and she said I was contagious. And we had to make rosary beads for the missions. And being the little jerk I was, I made them with 11 beads instead of 10 beads. And, you know, at the end of the 4 years, I had to tell her what I was doing, because it would have been like wasting 4 years of my life if she didn't know. And I went to her and I said, "You know what I've been doing?" And she said, "Yes, you sly little prince." She said, "Oh, every boy a prince and every girl a princess," because she said we had a father who's a king. And she said, "People all over the world are praying extra prayers, and God's going to give you all the credit." Don't you hate people like that, you know? And then she told me something that absolutely terrified me. She told me that she had put a medal on her beads. You know, the nuns used to wear those long beads that bang against the desk when you're taking your test. And she said, "Every time I get to this medal of St. Jude, I'd pray for you." And she said, "One day you're going to go around the world and tell God's children how much he loves them." And it absolutely terrified me. And I graduated from high school, and I did my very first inventory. I took my shirt off, and I stood in front of the mirror, and I flexed my muscles. And I was 5 feet, 1 inch tall. I weighed 113 pounds. I was a born killer, so I went to Wheeling, West Virginia, and joined the Marine Corps. And I wasn't yet 18 years of age, so my parents had to sign for me. And a recruiter came to my house and told my parents what I had done. And my poor mother lost it. She began to cry and everything. And my father said, "Son, are you sure you want to do this?" I said, "Dad, I thought about it a long time. It was like 10 minutes I thought about it." And so he reluctantly signed the papers. And all night my mother's crying. And she's saying, "Scott, they're going to kill him." And my dad kept saying, "Don't worry, Pat, they won't take them." And so the next morning, we didn't have a family car or anything like that. So the next morning, we got a taxi cab and went to Wheeling, West Virginia. I got on a Greyhound bus and went to Pittsburgh, 60 miles away. It's the second longest trip I'd ever been on. I went to Cleveland once. And it was a bad year, and they took you if you had a pulse. And it was 1961, and there were three guys from Pittsburgh who had also joined. And they said to me, after we were sworn in, they said, "Look, kid, we're going to go up and get a beer and a sandwich. You want to come with us?" And, you know, I was a guy who, I watched what you did, and I do exactly what you did, and because I had no earthly idea how to deal with life, nothing. And so I went with them to this bar, and we had like 10 hours before the train left. And I had my first drinking occasion. Well, actually, I had one when I was 5 years old. My father gave myself and my brother, Denny, who was four, a beer. My mother was either at the bingo or having a baby. And and, you know, she was an incredible woman in that she came under the authority of other human beings. You know, when she had her fourth child, my brother Terry, she nearly died. And the doctor said to her, "I want to tie your tubes so that you don't risk your life." And she talked to our pastor, Father Close, and she said to him, "What should I do?" And he said, "Why don't you trust God?" And, you know, she did. And then she had Leonard, Larry, Henry, Kathy, Susie, and Mark. Had she been selfish and self-centered, I wouldn't have these magnificent brothers and sisters that I have. And she was a humble, humble woman under the authority of God. And so we go off to this bar in Pittsburgh, And I'll never forget it. I was terrified. And, you know, I'm looking around. The only thing I knew about the Marine Corps is they took a certain number of men down to Parris Island and drowned them in a swamp. And I look around this room, and it's filled with real men. You know the kind, the steel workers and the coal miners and all that. And they all had real women with them. Guys like me used to get what was left. And the bartender came over and said, "What do you boys want?" And I thought, oh, no, a quiz. You know, I thought when you least expected it, they were going to say, take out a blank sheet of paper, put your name in the upper left-hand corner. And they were asking a bunch of questions, and I never knew what was going on in life. So I watched what the other guys did. They ordered a beer and a sandwich, so I did too. And then a guy came back and said, "What do you want?" And they ordered another beer, so I did too. Then he came back the third time and said, "What do you boys want?" And I said, "We want four beers." I'd become a leader between the second and third beer. And I stood up and looked around, and the floor looked like it was 6 feet, 4 inches below me. And my shoulders were out, the hair and the muscles were ripping through my body. And I looked around, and the room was filled with a bunch of pathetic, sniveling little men. And all I've had women with them are looking at me with their hungry eyes. You know how they do it. And I had become brilliant. And I'm going from table to table explaining life to all these people. And, you know, I drank the whole time. And the Marine Corps had provided us with a Pullman coach. We each had our own coach. So the next morning I wake up 300 miles from home. It's as far as I'd ever been from home in my life. And someone had wet the floor I was lying on, and whoever done it had wet me too. So I changed my clothes, and I got off the train, and the guys are waiting out there on the platform, and they said, "What took you so long?" And I didn't share. So they said, "What are you going to do?" I said, "I'm going to find something to drink." So I drank all day. And we ended up at Yamasee, South Carolina. If you hadn't been there, I wouldn't bother, but I fell off the train because I was very drunk, and there was a very rude man there. They called him a drill instructor. He was there to greet us, and he was shouting at us and using obscenities and things like that. And I brushed myself off, and I said to him, "Look, pal, that's not how you talk to a drill instructor." I said, "If you treat us with respect, you'll get a lot more out of us." And they said, "You can do anything, you know. And you learn from every experience." What I learned from that experience is you can do a lot of push-ups drunk. And, you know, you can push ups and throw up at the same time. And so the next morning they put us on a bus and took us to Parris Island. And I must tell you, I absolutely fell in love with it. I really did. I absolutely fell in love with the Marine Corps. And I was going to spend the rest of my life in the Corps. And I won Dress Blues Award and Outstanding Man's Award out of Parris Island. I was the smallest guy there, but I could do 100 push-ups before I went there. And I didn't tell anybody that, you know. I made it look like it was harder than it was. And every promotion I ever got in the Corps was a meritorious promotion. And I worked very, very hard to get a commission. In 1965, I was in Santo Domingo. I also made the Cuban Missile Crisis. We were on standby, and we went. And I'll never forget this leadership. There was a wonderful, our platoon sergeant was a gunnery sergeant named Gunnery Sergeant Bojarski. I'm up on a point, and there were 1,800 Marines in Guantanamo Bay, and there were 60,000 Cuban troops on the other side of the fence. And I'm up on the point, and I'm sweating bullets. And he came up and he said, "You know, son, if they know who they're messing with, they won't come across that fence." And I felt better. And then later, you know, I worked very, very hard to get my commission and everything. And then I passed all the tests and went through the whole routine. I'm in Santo Domingo in 1965. We had a little shooting thing there with the 82nd Airborne came down and joined us. And only 12 of us were killed. But what had happened was the Cubans came up through Haiti, Cuban troops and some Russian troops. And we killed a bunch of them, unfortunately. But that's what we were sent down here to do. And what terrified me and drove me out of the Marine Corps was my alcoholism. It cost me my very first dream. I led a combat patrol in a blackout. I wasn't supposed to lead it that night. You know, the night I led it, because I have superb night vision, which makes it hard with those lights in my eyes, but I have superb night vision. Julia turns all the lights on in the morning, but I walk around in the dark, and I put on sunglasses in the morning when she turns all the lights on. But what happened was the man who was supposed to lead the patrol that night was sick. So they came and got me, and I had been drinking since 5 o'clock in the afternoon in my tent. Next morning, I wake up with my flak jacket on. I have a .45 in my holster. There's a round in the chamber. The hammer's back. I almost never slept like that. And I was so terrified because the captain wanted me to report on a patrol the night before. We took fire and returned fire, and I don't remember any of it. And I had to find somebody who was on a patrol with me to tell me what had happened. And I was so afraid that I took my discharge and got out. And, you know, my men gave me this tie tack, Marine Corps tie tack, and I wear it in their honor. And some of them died in Vietnam. And I had a terrible survivor's guilt for the longest kind of time, drinking, and even in my sobriety. And Julia went to the wall with me. And I prayed a rosary for them and for their families. And then it hit me like a bolt of lightning that God had a different plan for my life. And I know He has a plan for each and every one of our lives. And it's a perfect plan if we're willing to come under His authority and under the authority of a sponsor. And, you know, I ended up marrying some poor, unfortunate woman. We had our first daughter, Kelly. And then we have our second daughter, and I'm passed out on the living room floor in my underwear watching the test pattern. That's what old drunks used to do. They used to watch a test pattern. Now they have cable. But and she called the neighbors, and they came over and threw water on me to wake me up. And I was in a bit of a rage. And so I took her to the hospital that I worked in, Georgetown University Hospital. And and she had this baby 3 months premature. She was barely over a pound. You could literally hold her in the palm of your hand. And I had long since gotten so sick, so spiritually ill, because that's what alcoholism is a spiritual illness. And I'd gotten so spiritually sick that I no longer believed in miracles, although I saw them my whole life. But now what used to be a miracle is now a coincidence. And I never forget, what a coincidence. The chief resident on the neonatal nursery was a girl I'd gone to high school with back in Ohio. What a coincidence. And then she said to me, she said, "Keith," she said, "we just bought an experimental machine. It's called a negative respirator." She said, "It's the first one on the East Coast. I'd like to, we put it together yesterday. I'd like your to put your daughter on it." And I said, "You know, do whatever you think is best." And I had an office across from the neonatal nursery. I supervised the genetics laboratories there. And I did a lot of work with these tiny little infants. And so I'm sitting in this room all by myself with the lights out at night, watching my wife walk up and down the hallway in a state of shock. And the third night is particularly critical for these kids. And so they didn't think she'd make it through the third night, and my wife went in and baptized her. And, you know, I knew what to do because I know what my father would have done. My father would have gone in and put his arm around his wife and said, "Pat, with God, we can do anything." That was, he was truly a man of faith. I knew what to do. I just didn't have anything left inside of me. You know, sobriety is all about building character. That's what the old-timers told me. That's why they told me to clean up my language and all this, all these things. And so what happened was in an utter panic, I ran down to the chapel. And trust me, I hadn't been in a chapel for a while, and because I'd given up on God, and because I was living with all these character defects that I didn't recognize as character defects. And I ran in and I got on my knees before the tabernacle and I begged God to save my little girl's life. I said, "If you, I'll do anything if you let her live. I'll stop drinking." And I was drunk in 12 hours. I drank when I thought drinking would kill my little girl. That's how powerless I was over the next drink. And one of my favorite philosophers is a Frenchman named Blaise Pascal. And he said, God created man in his own image. Unfortunately, man returned a favor. And I had created a God who would kill a little girl because her dad was sick. And that's not the God I serve today. And she didn't die. As a matter of fact, she lived. And she went on and became a magnificent young lady. She lives in Alabama now. And she's a school teacher and she married a dentist. And I was speaking up in Pensacola at a conference. And she was pregnant with her second daughter. And I called her up and said to her, Kimberly, how are you feeling? And she was crying. And she said, Daddy, I have kidney stones and it's causing contractions. And I'm afraid my little girl is going to come early. I'm afraid she'll be just like me. And I was able to say to her, if she's just like you, you'll be the luckiest mother in the world. And an AA member loaned me her car. And I drove 3 hours and held my little girl in my arms. And we cried together and we prayed together. And her little girl was born at term, and she's just a magnificent young girl, just like her mother. And you know, I ended up, my wife finally threw me out because I'm falling asleep with cigarettes and that sort of thing, and she asked me to leave. So I ended up where I had to go, which was the basement of a house in the Skid Row section of Washington, D.C. And here I am. Dying. And, you know, I somehow made it to work, but, and they kept paying me. And the man I worked for was an absolute brilliant man. He was a Jesuit priest. He had his PhD in genetics, had it in philosophy, had it in theology. Unfortunately, he passed away last month. And he prayed me sober. I know he did. And here I am living in this place. And, you know, I had a medicine cabinet full of drugs. I never took drugs. I thought if God made anything better than alcohol, he kept it for himself. And some of you think that's the saddest story you ever heard. But, you know, you could take whatever you wanted out of the brewer at the hospital. So I had this whole thing. And on May the 13th, 1973, I walked into what passed for a bathroom. And I put all of these pills in one glass, and I'm going to take them all. And I screamed out loud, you're 29 years old, at least it'll be over. And I heard a woman, literally heard a woman's voice speak to me saying, it's starting. And I was startled. I was absolutely amazed. And I remembered I had a phone number and I called it. And Ernie R., we called him Ernie the attorney, had started a little treatment center. And I called him and asked him if I could come. And they said, yes, you need $300 to get in. So I took, the next day, I took the title to my little alcoholic car to the bank to borrow $300. And I'm outside, and I put a nickel in a parking meter, and Beethoven's Fifth Symphony starts playing out of the parking meter. And I stood there for 12 minutes till my time was up, and I put another nickel in. I could have saved a nickel because it was playing in the bank, too. And then I get home, and I'm really, really sick, and I'm leaning against a tree, and it's playing out the knothole of a tree. And back then, you didn't go to the hospital with what I had, so I spent 3 days flopping around on the floor and all that stuff. And finally, it was time for me to go to this place. And I got in the car, and it was only 30 miles away, but it took me 5 hours to drive 30 miles. Here I am, sick and all kinds of things. And I wet my pants, and I'm changing my pants on the side of the road outside of Washington, D.C., and my Phi Theta Kappa key fell out of my pocket, and I wonder what happened to the kid with all the potential. I tell you, potential dissolves in alcohol. And I get to the treatment center, And they put me on a bus and sent me to a place called Alcoholics Anonymous, which I had never heard of. And because I never did any research, trust me. And they had a wonderful old man there who was a greeter. And he shook my hand and he said, "Son, welcome to Alcoholics Anonymous." He said, "You know, you never have to drink again." And I wanted to say to him, "Look, pal, you don't know me. I'm a guy who drinks when he thinks drinking will kill his little girl." But he did know me. And more importantly, he knew you. He knew that you had exactly what I needed. And so what happened was, I was sober about 2 weeks. And I just hated myself. I really did. I just hated myself. So I go back to this meeting. And the same man said to me, he said, "Son, how's it going?" And I said, "I don't deserve this." And he said to me, "You know, son, if your head hits a pillow tonight, you haven't had a drink today. Today you're a winner." And I blew him off and went into the meeting. And I went back to that little treatment center. I'm sleeping on a cot up in the attic. And I lay down, my head hits a pillow, and those words came back, and I burst into tears. You know, to this day, 33 years and a few months later, every time my head hits a pillow at night, I'm overwhelmed with gratitude. And and early on, I met a guy named Buck Doyle, who was a Flying Tiger. He's an absolutely magnificent member of Alcoholics Anonymous. And if you were new, you always had a bruise on your chest, because he'd always poke you in the chest and tell you a story. And he said to me, he said, "You know, kid," he said, "your problem's spiritual in nature." He said, "If you don't find a spiritual solution, you're going to die of alcoholism." And later I said to him, "You put a bruise on my chest." He said, "That's so when you take a shower, you'll remember what I told you." And he said, "If you try to solve your emotional problems to get well," he said, "you'll chase your tail till you die of alcoholism." He said, "What you have is a spiritual illness and you need a spiritual solution." And then a guy told me one time, he said, "You're really deluded. That's what it says in the big book." And so I went to a friend of mine named Jack, who was a magnificent old-timer. And I said to Jack, I said, "What's delusion?" He smiled at me and he said, "You know, kid," he said, "delusion ain't what you don't know. It's knowing things that just ain't so." He said, "We call them old ideas." And these people were absolutely amazing people. And I got my very first sponsor. His name was Dan C. In my 33 years, I've had 4 sponsors. And Dan was my very first sponsor, and he was absolutely magnificent. He just celebrated 35 years last October, and he did so much for me. He helped me define my problems. I think it's important because, you know, every Monday night from 7 to 10, he and I would go to the intergroup office, and he would answer the phone. He didn't let me have the phone, and so he said to me, he said, "How is your financial life?" I said, "I'm hopelessly in debt." He said, "Only the United States government is hopelessly in debt." He said, "I want you to make a budget." And so what I did was the next Monday I brought this budget to him. And he said, "I want you to list the bills you pay by priority." And I had rent, food, cigarettes, and all this stuff. And then 4 or 5 down the row, I had child support. And he circled child support, and he ran it up to the top. He said, "You have one moral obligation, and that's to support your children. Write this check first every month." And I did. And then I was $100 a month in a hole. And, you know, 1974, that was a lot of money. And the next day, Tuesday morning, I get a call from the guy from Ernie the attorney, and he asked me if I'd come to his DWI school and do a lecture every week. And he said, "Well, I'll pay you $25 a lecture." That was my $100. So then I go to the hospital, and there's a note on my desk in my office from the chairman of the Department of Obstetrics and Gynecology, Dr. Paul Bruns. He's been gone now for a while. But Paul was a pigeon of Buck Doyle, and he was also a paratrooper. He had paratrooped into Normandy, And he was an absolutely magnificent man. And I went to him and he said, "I'm so proud of what you've done." And I had almost a year then. And he said, "I'm so proud of what you've done." He said, "I think that it's very, very important that I give you a raise, but I can't because there's a wage and price freeze in effect." And he said, "But I can give you this." And he gave me, and I opened a letter, and it was a full scholarship to Georgetown University. So I went and took a degree in philosophy and theology. And then I went down to my office, and my boss was there, Father Bowmiller. And he gave me all these chits for free books. I never bought a book the whole time I was in Georgetown University. And then I get a call from this lady who's in the admissions department. And I'd given her son, right after I got back from the treatment center, I gave her son a job for 3 months because he needed to work in a laboratory before he could get into Tufts Medical School. And so I gave him a job, and she called me up, and she said, "I heard you got a scholarship." And she said, "You're a veteran, aren't you?" And I said, "Yes, I am." And I said, "But my VA benefits have expired. My education benefits have expired." She said, "Today, President Ford's signing a bill that extends you Vietnam-era guys." And so I went from $100 a month in a hole to $400 a month ahead. And, you know, had I not defined the problem, I still would have felt as though I was hopelessly in debt. So my sponsor always had me define the problem. You know, when I was sober just a few months or a couple months, I was absolutely crazy. And I forgot where I worked. And my sponsor had given me his business card and taped a dime to it. And he said, "If you ever need me, call me." So I called him. And I didn't want to tell him I didn't know where I worked because I didn't think he'd want to sponsor anybody who didn't know where they worked. And so I called him from the phone booth, and he said to me, "How's it going?" And I said, "Oh, I'm fine. How are you?" And he said, "What's the problem?" And I said, "I can't remember where I work." And he said, "There are a lot of people who can't remember where they work." He said, "When you pour enough alcohol in your brain," he said, "strange things happen. That's what the big book tells us." And I said, "Yes, it does." And then he said to me, he told me where I worked. And the minute he told me, I even knew what I did. And so then he said to me, he said, "If you ever have this problem again," he said, "try to remember to look at the front bumper of your car because you have a parking permit for the university." I'm thinking, where do these people learn these things? You know, they make life look so easy. And, you know, about a month later, I get a letter from Dr. Jerome Lejeune in Paris, France, and he invited me to come and study with him. And I knew sponsorship. I knew they found out what you wanted to do, and they said, "You can't do it." And so I gave the letter to Dan, and he just beamed. And he said to me, he said, "This is perfect." He said, "This isn't about you. This is about Alcoholics Anonymous." And, you know, I'd been drunk in France when I was in the Marine Corps. And he said to me, he said, "Look at me." And that's what my mother used to say when she really meant it. And so I'd look at him, and he said, "You can do anything in Alcoholics Anonymous if you prepare properly." He said, "We have 4 months to prepare you to go to Paris to study." And we did the steps, and we did a number of things. I got a contact with a man in Paris, and he was a man, his name's Don, and he was the man who took AA to France. He worked for the State Department. And I spoke down at Hilton Head Island about 8 or 9 months ago for a good friend of mine who celebrated 52 years. And Don came up to me, and he's retired down there now. And so here I am. I'm glad I'm sitting all by myself next to the bulkhead in the airplane, because here I am landing in Orly Airport, and the tears are running down my cheeks. 7 months before, I was dying of alcoholism on Skid Row in Washington, D.C. And here I am walking the streets of Paris, a free man. And you know what a strange thing. Dan showed up a week later and spent a week with me in Paris. And we went to we went to look at a variety of things. We took a train ride, and he was just absolutely wonderful. And, you know, when I got sober, when you introduced yourself, people didn't say hello. in Washington, you know. And so the first time I ever heard that, Dawn had asked me to lead a meeting in Paris at the American Church on the Seine River. And I'm holding this cup of coffee, and there's a woman from Iowa. I said, "My name's Keith. I'm an alcoholic." And she said, "Hi, Keith," in my ear, and I dropped the coffee in my lap. So every time I hear that now, I get a warm feeling. And then when I completed my work in Paris, I went to Rome and spent a few weeks in a monastery. And they only had one meeting in all of Rome at that time. It was at 13 Via Napoli. And there was only one Italian. And, you know, later when Sandy B was my sponsor and he spoke at the International in New Orleans in 1980, and he took me up front with him. He was allowed to take one person up front, and he took me with him. And I sat down, and Lois Wilson sat down next to me, and she patted my hand and said, "I'm so glad to see young people like you in Alcoholics Anonymous." And then the man I had met in Rome translated the big book from English to Italian and gave her the very first copy. And, you know, the things that have happened in my life have just been absolutely overwhelming. You know, when I was sober 3 years, you know, I spent a lot of time with my children. And my daughter Kimberly taught me so much because I watched her. You know, she struggled for the first few years she was alive. And when she was three when I got sober, and Kelly was four. And I used to take them to the zoo a lot, and because I lived pretty close to the zoo. And we had a picnic by Rock Creek Park. And And Kelly was a very athletic young lady. She was ambidextrous. She could throw stones right and left-handed. And Kimberly is left-handed, and she picked up a stone and tried to throw it, and it went up in the air, and it came down and hit her on the head. And so I'm watching her. And then she gathered a pile of stones. And then she went over and had her little jacket, and she folded her jacket up and held it on the top of her head. And started trying to throw stones. And finally, one of them stuck the end of her finger, and she threw it halfway across the creek, and it splashed. And she turned around and looked at me, and she said, "I did it, Daddy. I did it." And I burst into tears. You know, and, you know, the other thing that happened to me at around 3 months, you know, which is a difficult time in sobriety, and I was really kind of hurting, and I was getting very defiant and angry and fearful and all that stuff. And so I go to my home group, and there's a man there named Happy Harold. And Happy Harold was leading the meeting on the second step. And my head was so busy that I didn't hear much of what anybody said. And we always used to go for coffee after meetings. And so we went to the Potter House for coffee on Columbia Road. And I'm sitting with some of my friends at a different table. And I get up to leave. And one of my favorite readings in Alcoholics Anonymous Comes of Age is the definition of fellowship that Bernard Smith quotes Canon C.E. Raven. And one of the things it says is that we know one another. And so I'm walking by. I'm so overwhelmed with guilt because of my children and all the stuff I had done and everything, and you know, the men who died in the Marine Corps and all this stuff. And so I'm walking by Harold's table, and he reached out and takes me by the arm, and he said, "You look troubled, son." And I said, "I feel guilty." And he said, "I know how you feel." And he pulled up a chair and he said, "Sit down." And he told me a story that changed my life. He said, "You know, my mother called me from the intensive care unit and said, 'Harold, I want you to come and see me, but I don't want you to be drunk because I don't want to go into eternity seeing my oldest boy drunk.'" And he said, "The next morning I showed up at the hospital and I was drunk." And I said, "You were?" He said, "Yes." He said, "I hadn't met you people yet. I didn't know how not to be drunk." And his brothers and sisters said, "Harold, you can't go up there like that." So he called up to the intensive care unit, and they took a phone to his mother, And he said, "Mama, can I come and see you?" And she said, "Are you drinking, boy?" And he said, "Yes, ma'am." She said, "I don't want to see you like that." And he said, "My brothers and sisters said goodbye to my mother. And I sat down in the waiting room and she died." And I said, "How do you live with that?" And Harold smiled. He's a wonderful African-American man. And he smiled at me and he said, we called him Happy Harold. And he said, "The worst thing you do will become your greatest gift in Alcoholics Anonymous." And, you know, a couple months later, I'm in the hospital and I see Harold by the elevator, and we went over and shook hands and talked for a few minutes, and then he got on the elevator and left. And I turn around, there's a nurse standing there. She said, "Do you know Mr. B?" And I said, "You mean Happy Harold?" She said, "He's the finest man I know." He said, "Whenever we have an old person here who has no family members and they're dying, we call Harold and he comes and helps them die." That was before hospice started. And I was overwhelmed and burst into tears, because the worst thing you do will become your greatest gift. That's the magnificence of the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, and then Sandy, after a few years, Sandy became my sponsor. And he was an absolutely magnificent sponsor. And we went through the steps again together and all of that stuff. And he was incredible. And I just owe him so very, very much. And was asked to open a treatment center when I was sober about 3 years. And I did it in a psychiatric institute. And I was there for 4 years, and I worked with Sandy. And what happened was a good friend of mine, Ted C., Dr. Ted C., who's sober well over 40 years now, got sober in Massachusetts, and he called me up, and I had gone to school with him in 1974 in Minneapolis, and he called me up and asked me if I would come down and open a treatment center at a psychiatric hospital. He was a medical director, and I told him I would. And you know how miracles happen to us. Here I am, sitting on a balcony overlooking the lake in this little apartment that I rented. And I was overwhelmed with gratitude. And I'm reading the big book and the big book, and which I read every day, and because I need spiritual nourishment. And so what happened was, I'm sitting there, and I said, "Why me, Father? Why have you picked me? I'm sober 7 years now." I said, "Why have you picked me?" And I remember when I was in that treatment center, I called my poor estranged wife, and I said to her, "I'm an alcoholic." She said, "No kidding." And I said, "Why me?" She said, "Why not you? If anybody deserves it, you do." And she hung up. So I'm asking God, "Why me, Father? Why have you picked me?" And I heard him say, "If anybody deserves it, you do." And he loves each and every one of us so very, very much. You know, and when I was sober 12 years, actually 13 years, I went to my 25th high school reunion. And I had to make an amends to a good friend of mine named Richard. When he was in the third grade, he was a very kind man, and I loved being on his team. And he'd always pick me to be on his team. And this one day, a new guy moves to town, and so he picked a new guy to be on his team. And I ended up on the other team, and I was so hurt and angry and everything, and I punished him. And he came up to me a few days later. I didn't talk to him for like 3 days. And he said to me, he said, "I have an extra Twinkie. Do you want it?" And I never saw a kid with an extra Twinkie. But I said, "Don't you want it?" And he said, "No." So I threw it on the ground, stepped on it, walked away. And so I'm at my 25th high school reunion, and Richard's there. And I went over and I said to him, I said, I need to make an amends to you. He said, "For what?" I said, "I stomped on your Twinkie." And he laughed, and he said, "Yeah." He said, "Are you an Alcoholics Anonymous?" I said, "I am." He said, "You know, some of my best friends in Columbus, Ohio, are members of Alcoholics Anonymous." He said, "That's a magnificent organization." And then he told me something. He said, You know, he said in 1953, on May the 13th, we were knighted into the Knights of Fatima together, which was an apparition that took place in Portugal in 1917. And he said, Bishop John King Musio, who was the Bishop of Steubenville, Ohio, said, "The worst day of your life, the Mother of Jesus will be there for you." It was 20 years to the day later when I heard that woman say to me, "Your life's beginning." And, you know, miracle after miracle after miracle happens in Alcoholics Anonymous if we're willing to go along with the program and come under the authority of God and under the authority of a sponsor. I never make a decision that I don't run it by my sponsor, my wife, and she's an ex-cop. And she told me the reason I married her was she was the first woman I ever met who had her own handcuffs. And, you know, and the most difficult amends I ever had to make, were there two of them actually. One of them was to religious people. And Sandy went through my list, my eight-step list with me, and we threw a couple people out because my ego was driving it. And then we included a couple people. And, you know, I really hated religious people. I had great joy when they fell apart or something happened because I had become so spiritually sick. And the old-timers told me to go back to the church of your childhood and great healing will take place. And that was some of the best advice I ever received. But here I am, and I had religious people on my amends list. And I'll never forget this. I went down to a Jesuit retreat house on the eastern shore of Maryland looking for this young theologian who taught me theology. And I knew he'd understand the deep significance of this humble act I'm about to perform. And I couldn't find him. There's this old man sitting in his room in a rocking chair reading his breviary. And so finally I knocked on the door and said, "Father, could I talk to you?" He said, "Of course, son, come in." And I sat in a rocking chair. And I said to him, I told him why I was there. I told him the things I had said about people like him. And, you know, he'd been a priest 50 years. And he had an illness that was going to allow him to go home soon. And I'm telling him what I'm doing. And he took the blanket off his lap, and he got up and he pulled me out of the rocking chair and he put his arms around me. He began to cry and he said, "Son, God sent you." I said, "Excuse me?" He said, "God sent you." He said, "I was just asking my higher power, where have I failed in my 50 years as a priest?" And he said, "Too often I hung around with people who agreed with me and liked me." And he said, "My higher power told me I had to go look for the one that was lost." He said, "I'm sorry you had to be out there all alone." And he's crying, and I'm crying. And, you know, driving back to Washington, I had to pull off the road a half dozen times because my eyes would fill up with tears that God would use somebody like me to carry a message to a man who had been the best priest he could be for 50 years. You know, and the other difficult time was my father and my brother Terry. Whenever I'd try to go home, Terry would always disappear. And Terry ended up with lung cancer. He also was alcoholic. And so I drove up to visit with him in the hospital. And I never forget this as long as I live. He asked a question I think you might want to ask your older brother. You know, he's lying there in bed. And he'd been a good professional boxer and everything. Now he had lung cancer and he's dying. And he said to me, he said, "Do you believe there's a God?" And I said, "Terry, I know there's a God more than I know anything in the world." And then he asked a question that I would have asked in his position. He said, "You think he could care about a guy like me?" I said, "Terry, he did everything for you and me." And so I happened to have an extra rosary and an extra scapular and all that. And I asked Terry for a favor. I said, "Could I hug you?" And he said, "Of course you can hug me." And he got out of bed and he was very frail. And I only hugged him for a few seconds. But driving back, I remembered something I learned in theology. There are two kinds of time. There's something called chronos, chronological time, which is linear. And then there's something called kairos, which is God's time. And the old timers always told me, you can only know God in the present moment. You can know about Him in the past. You can see how He touched your life in the past, but you can only know Him in the present. And so I'm thinking, you know, I only hugged Terry a few seconds chronologically, but in God's time I hugged him forever. And to this day he lives in my heart. And, you know, he said to me before I left, he said, you know, I think I can be like you. I think I can stop drinking. And I talked to him frequently on the phone, and he made amends to every member of the family that he could. He had stolen from and done all kinds of things. And, you know, on May the 14th, 1993, the day after my 20th AA birthday, my mother walked in his room, and Terry was sitting in the rocking chair, and he was dead, and he had a rosary that I'd given him in his hand. He died talking to God. He died sober. He died surrounded by people who loved him. And that's the way I want to go. I'm in no hurry, but that's the way I want to go. And then the other amends was my father, because my father was such a good man. And, you know, neither he nor my mother had ever seen the ocean. And I had a beach house. The name of the house was CZ Does It. And I was offered a position as a vice president in Birmingham, Alabama, in a hospital corporation. And I asked them to come down and keep an eye on my beach house. And my brothers and sisters chipped in, and we all chipped in and bought my dad a car. And whenever I would be in the Carolina area, I'd always stop by and spend some time with him. And my father was such a man of character that I competed with him. I think men compete with dad and women compete with mom. And I always competed with him. And he was, you know, so I'd always stop by. And my prayer partner, Mike Way, told me, he said, if you can't make amends to your father, honor him. He said, stop arguing with him. You don't have to be right and all of that. So I did. I did all that. I stopped arguing with him. I no longer debated with him. I didn't do anything. And you know, I'm down there one day, and he said to me, he said, remember the first day you went to work? And I said, yes, Dad. I said, I was 12 years old, and I worked in a bowling alley setting pins. And he said, I took you to Louis' hot dog stand. He said, remember what you had? And I said, a hot dog. And he said, remember what you drank? And I said, I always drank orange pop. He said, not that day, son. He said, that day you drank root beer, because I drank root beer, and I think you thought men who worked drank root beer. And he said, I explained to you how to do a good day's work for a good day's pay. My father's telling this little boy how to grow up. And he said, I walked you down to the bus stop and said, you want me to come with you the first day? And you said, no thanks, Dad, I'll do it myself. And he said, from then on, you never let me do anything for you. He said, you put yourself through high school, you put yourself through college. He said, all your brothers and sisters let me help them. You never let me help you. And I realized why I owed my father an amends. I didn't let him do what he was put on earth to do, and that is to be my father. So the next month I came through, I borrowed $1,000 from him. You know, I put it in a bank, and the next month I gave it back to him. And from then on, we were just like that. And I allowed him to help me. And then, you know, after 6 years, my mother said to me, she said, you know, we had our honeymoon and we had all of our vacations at your beach house. And people would stop by and they'd see the sign, CZ Does It. And they'd stop by and ask my mother, are you a friend of Bill Wilson? She said, no, my son Keith's a friend of Bill Wilson. And so what happened was they moved back up to Ohio because my father's sister was very ill and was dying, and my brother Denny bought the house my dad grew up in and remodeled it for him and everything, and that's where they lived. And you know, a few years after my brother Terry passed away, my mother contracted cancer, and I'll never forget this. You know, when the first token I ever received in AA was 4 years, and Sandy gave it to me, And my mother saw it, and she said, I'd love to have one of those coins. And I said, take this one. She said, no, that's yours. And so from then on, every year, I sent my father and my mother a token and I'd write them a thank you note, and I would recall a story where they taught me a principle or where they, you know, did something magnificent. They blamed themselves for my alcoholism. Why wouldn't they blame themselves for my sobriety? You know, and my mother was dying, and she said to me, she said, always go to Alcoholics Anonymous. Those are the people who brought my boys back to me. And she listed a few of the things she wanted to take in her coffin with her. And at the top of that list was my 23-year token. And, you know, I would sit up at night and pray a rosary aloud, and she would pray with me for a while, or I'd read scripture, and she would sit and listen to it and that sort of thing. And she was just a magnificent human being. And then some years later, in 2001, my father was very, very ill. He was 89 years of age. And Julie and I went up to see him. And he did something that was absolutely amazing to me. He got out these old pictures I had never seen. And there was a high school baseball championship team. And I said to him, I said, Dad, I said, I heard you were a pretty good ball player. He said, I was okay. And I said, I heard you were All-State. He said, well, I was. I said, were you All-State your senior year? He said, actually, I was All-State all 4 years. And I said, a friend of yours told me years ago that you were offered a professional contract. He said, actually, I was offered three of them. And I said, why didn't you do it? And listen to this. He said, Mom and Dad were sick, and I had a job in a factory, and they needed me at home. That's the kind of man he was. He honored his parents by giving up the dream of his heart. And then I got down on my knee, and I took his hand in my hand, and I said, Daddy, is there anything we need to say to one another that we haven't said? He said, no, son. I know you love me, and you know I love you. And I gave him a hug and a kiss, and I started to leave, and he said, there's one thing I want to say to you. And I said, what's that, Dad? And he said, you have turned into one of the most magnificent, honorable men I've ever known in my life because of your friends in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I ran over and hugged him and kissed him. And then we were, a couple months later, my sister Susie called. And Susie said, Daddy's really close to the end. So Joey and I drove back up to Ohio. And I'll never forget this. He spent some time with my brother Terry's daughter. And then we went in, and he was very close to the end. And we all stood around his bed. And I knelt down next to his bed, and I took his hand and held it next to my heart, and I whispered in his ear, it's okay to go, Dad. I'll pray for everything you pray for every day. And every day from that day till this one, I prayed for everything he would have prayed for, which is my brothers and sisters. And we prayed the Hail Mary, and then we prayed the Lord's Prayer. And when we said amen, my father squeezed my hand and went into eternity. And I walked outside the room and I said to Julia, I'm not supposed to live like this. I'm supposed to be down the street trying to drink up enough courage to come here. But of course I'm supposed to live like this because this is how you taught me to live. You've given me absolutely everything. You know, when I was sober 30 days, we had to do a cut down. Doctor did a cut down on a woman, and because she had leukemia. She was 30 years old, and she was absolutely beautiful, red hair, and she was looking at me, and I was collecting the samples so I could grow the cells and look at them. And she said, because of my illness, my husband took my two boys and left. And I'm thinking, because of my illness, my wife took my two girls and left. And then she said, I'd do anything if I could live. And, you know, I visited her every day for the next 30 days, and she passed away. And, you know, I've been given 33 years and nearly 3 months because of you magnificent people. I'll do whatever you tell me to do. And it's all about service. And it's all about caring. And you've taught me absolutely everything. My sponsor now is John H., who lives on Hilton Head Island. And he's absolutely a wonderful, wonderful man. And Tom I. was my sponsor for nearly 20 years up in North Carolina. And he did absolutely everything for me. And, you know, the 2nd of February, he'll be celebrating 50 years. That's a lot of not drinking. And he did virtually everything for me. And, you know, some of the things that happened have been absolutely incredible in my life. And a big part of the 11th step, I'm convinced, is looking back and seeing how God put exactly the right person in my life at exactly the right time. Dan C., I was sober 5 weeks when I went to my first institution. And I said to him, I said, what do I say? And he said, you don't have to say anything. He said, take an extra pack of cigarettes, they'll like you. And so I did. And then, you know, I was sober 3 years, and my daughters, Kelly and Kimberly, they used to argue over who sat in the front seat next to Daddy. Well, they both get in the back seat, and so I know something's up. And I'm driving around the Beltway, and I hear them back there whispering to one another. And then Kelly gave a signal, and they said, Daddy, please don't smoke. You have a right to kill yourself, but you don't have a right to kill two innocent little children. And, you know, I pulled off the Beltway, and I said, okay, get out. They said, oh, Daddy, and they laughed, you know. And so I went to Sandy, who was then my sponsor, and I said to him, I said, I've done so much damage. I've caused so much chaos in their life. I said, I want to show them an adult can do anything. And he said, we'll put together a plan that will work. And he said, every day for 30 days, we are going to pray that you stop smoking. And on October the 15th, 1976, I threw away two cartons of cigarettes. I had a good friend who was a lawyer with the Russian embassy, and I threw away a bunch of Cuban cigars. I had pipe tobacco delivered to my house every month. And I wrapped up my pipes that I collected from around the world when I was in the Marine Corps. And I wrapped them up and sent them to my father. And I haven't had a cigarette from that day till this one. And to this day, Kelly and Kimberly say to me, Daddy, you prove to us an adult can do anything if they get God behind them to help. And that is absolutely the truth. I just want you to know how profoundly grateful I am to be part of the 50th convention. You know, the last time I spoke at a 50th one was in Colorado in 1993. And this is really an honor as a Floridian to be part of this. And I want to thank you very much.